Welcome to Ever Beyond, 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 Beyond,
on Wolf Spirit Radio, Ever Beyond Radio, and Tiernasau in Ireland.
Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, beyond.
Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Well, good afternoon, good evening, good morning. It's a slightly more complicated Ever Beyond today because we're on video looking at you. Yes, you. You're very special because you're listening to Ever Beyond, reducing your karmic footprint. Huh. Today's guest is a very visual guest because he's an artist. He's not just any artist. He's just not just any old fine painter who paints portraits, but he paints portraits of specific kind of people. The kind of people we like. The kind of people who we call whistleblowers, people who are maybe at once disgruntled or disgusted with what they've been made to do, people who step forward despite threats to their life, to their families, people who sacrifice a great deal. We know I won't go through, well, we'll see today. Some of these people, they've all done heroic things for us, and so it's wise to, you know, respect their counsel when we listen to them. So another great fan of these whistleblowers, so great a fan that instead of talking to them, he's painted their portrait beautifully. So without any further ado, my guest, Doug Auld. Good afternoon, Doug.
Yes. Hello, JP, and thanks for having me on your show.
Okay. So now turn off your screen share. You'll see a little button at the top says stop that, so I can see your face for a minute.
Okay. Let's see if I can learn to do that.
Yeah, we're just learning about how to use Google Hangouts and how to in a minute.
Let's see if I can do that.
We'll hold on. There we are. There you are. Doug Auld. Good afternoon. How are you, mate?
Hey, nice to see you. Thank you.
Excellent. So, today, as I said, we're doing a visual because as people can see from your background there, and I'm not talking about your, you know, your historic background, but like literally the things behind you, your background are a multitude of images and paintings and, do you want to lead us, show us your room for a start, Doug?
Oh, okay. Well, I live in a studio apartment here and it's, painted brown walls and some people would call morbid paintings. I don't see it at all like that. I'm proud of all my work. They're my children, but, there's a lot of different varieties of paintings in this room. Burn survivors, you can see several burn survivors on the wall. And there are large paintings hanging all around my place. That was one of my earlier series of works. But I think I'll just put the computer right there and show you some things on my site. But so I live around my art and I live around my music, and that's what I do.
So yeah, music. You've created some music that you work with another member of Connection Conscious with.
Yes.
Very beautiful it is. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, many years ago, I was a musician, maybe in my early 20s, late teens and early 20s. I got interested in music after seeing the Doors play in the Philadelphia Spectrum. And I was an auto mechanic, and I was supposed to go into my dad's car business. And much to the chagrin of my father, I was very hooked on the music of that time, and I went out and bought a keyboard and started to learn to play piano. And so from there, it kind of took off, and I studied some classical for a while, and I had a band with my brother Greg and two friends, and we actually played in CBGBs at a time. We played around the New York area a few times. Not a lot, but we were one of those bands that was in the laboratory, so to speak, all the time practicing and working on things. And I wrote music back then, but I let it go. The music business was, I don't know, it just wasn't for me at the time. I wasn't into, you know, hanging out in the bars and the nightclubs till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm also an avid ice hockey player for the last 30 or 40 years, actually. And I'm always up in the morning to play ice hockey. So I don't know, all these callings got in the way. So anyway, I continued recently, within the last 3 or 4 years, I decided to start to look at music again after I've been mainly concentrating on my art. So, now I'm getting back into songwriting for myself. And I had the pleasure of having, Sean Fuse, on my, I think that's how you say her last name. Sean, forgive me. I've had the pleasure on Connecting Consciousness website to meet her and have her sing a couple of my songs. And the last song that I wrote was called Open Prayer. So maybe we'll get a moment to play that later on.
Sean Fuse is how she pronounces it. Yes, Hank. Oh, stop that. Stop that. There we go. Headphones on and stop coming out the speakers. Yeah, Sean Amphies, her dulcet tones have been, have graced the Ever Beyond, stage before. She came on sometime last year. It was lovely. Hang on, I'll turn my camera back. I was just, saving bandwidth by, keeping my camera off there. There we go. So you got these two threads. Music and art. Were you in any other form? I mean, did you like do accountancy or, you know, anything in that way, or is it purely? Have you purely been artist and doing all that for all of your time?
Well, I would say that auto mechanics, which I was very fascinated with and started with, was always a person that I would consider to be a tinkerer. I like to take things apart, put them back together. And I still see that as relating very deeply to all my work. Art and music in my view, the way I see it is all interrelated. It's all problem solving for me. I never really know how I'm going to do a particular painting. I've been painting all these years and I'm like, I don't know. Can I do this again? Do I want to make a new painting? You're staring at a white canvas and it always seems so impossible or daunting. And lo and behold, the second I start and I just go into my space and I start to problem solve, the answers start to come. And it's the same thing with me with music. I usually write a lyric first. I like to write things that are meaningful to me on my observations of life today and what I see people going through, what I see the conditions of where we're at in society and so on. I like to make comment on that in as best way possible and also having an entertaining quality to it. And I usually write the lyrics first and then I read the lyric and think about it. And usually sometimes in a dream, sometimes I wake up in the morning, and I got some music going on in my head. I don't know where it came from, but I'll start to piece together some music for that lyric. And again, it's a problem solving idea. I like to build and make things. And that's an extension of my early days as an auto mechanic.
Oh, that's lovely. So you're bringing your lefts and the rights together to fuse, if you may excuse me, to fuse, the divine being, the male and the female. I was talking in the earlier show about how the soul used to be regarded as the opposite gender to the person. So, if you're a person, if you're a male, you have a female anima, and if you're female, you have a male animus. Mm. This is like an ancient teaching, isn't it?
Yeah, and I guess I wouldn't, not to say I too deeply know much about that. I mean, I've come across it in all my readings and stuff, but I would say that sounds pretty good. I think we all have that in us. And so, yeah, but I mean, of recent, I've all of a sudden started to like the idea of going to music more. Because I have felt that I don't know, maybe some of the listeners will understand this. I felt like I don't want to pile up material things anymore. I'm like, you know, I have all these paintings all over my studio and a lot of them, many over the years have sold, but a lot of them are out in my friends' homes and this and that, and they're large works. And, the art climate, the art business, so to speak, is, not something I was very gravitated towards. I've actually had a lot of media attention on my work over the years, more than gallery interest. And the world of art is not something that's very attractive for me. It's this idea of, okay, now we know you as the so-and-so painter, and now you got to paint 50 of them and let's get going and, like, you know, product and career and I don't know. The whole thing starts to work antithetical to the way I think. I like to be pure about when I make something. If I end up making 50 of something, which I did with the 50 whistleblowers, I ended up making it because I wanted to make it, not because someone said, now, all right, you did 5 and we can sell these and now we need 45 more. I'm not very good at that. So I start something and I get going on it and I do it with all my conviction, and when it's run its course, it's run its course. So so in a sense I said, let me go to music because it's just this ethereal out in the ozone vibration that doesn't really take up much space. So I'm kind of interested in moving in that area too right now. So
With all the music equipment that now can be squeezed into a teeny tiny little space like that. You know, I use this thing I was talking to you the other week, called Reason, to make music. And the version that's currently on is like Reason 6. I use 2.5 or something, and it's a really old one. But it does me, because all I want to do is like have backing, like piano, drums, bass, you know, all the things that I can't actually physically play, and then, sure. get the machine to do that, and then I can play my guitar and sing. So that's how I make my music generally. But if you can actually play the keyboards, you know, actually put fingers on keys at the right place and right time, then you've got a vast vista of being able to produce all kinds of music, digitally, for cheap, you know, almost for free.
Yeah. Well, I'm, and what I'm telling everybody could not be done without the aid of something called GarageBand, because I can play the keyboard. I would never call myself a performer. I'm not interested in going out into the world and performing or playing the piano. There are people much more, qualified to play music, but what I like to do is build a scaffold of a song and, foundation and throw up the wallboard and the drapes and paint the walls on it and have it as a presentation for what I would hope to have, a singer or a musical group or somebody else take on and do their version of. So, that's what I'm interested in. And the way I do this is I have a Kawai, piano. That's a fantastic instrument that, I put into the Apple, put the Apple computer and that together. And not only do I play the piano parts, then I write the bass lines. I play the bass and I play the drums and I put a loop to it and, whatever else I can, the strings and everything else that I can do. And then what was great, working with Sean is that, once I got this done and saved the file, I emailed the file to Shauna over in, the West Coast. She got it, and she's savvy with the GarageBand also, and there she goes. She puts her tracks on it and sends it back to me. And so we've never met, and yet she sang a song for me. So this could never be done in the past, and I don't know what this is doing to musicians and how they feel about it, because they must be like, you know, there they go. They're like, you know, cutting out the orchestra. You know, thanks for teaching you know, having me learn the cello, but now you're playing it on the keyboard. So, and you know, even if it's not perfect, it gives you the idea of what the structure of the song is. So that's how I do it. I do it by myself. I don't really require musicians, and I wish I could sing. That's one thing I can't. If I could sing, then I would do it all myself, but, I need the help of other singers for that.
Well, sometimes we all need an extra singer or two. you know, yeah, even backing vocalists. I tell you, backing vocalists, they can make everything sound a lot more, a lot nicer than it started out. But anyway, yeah, you know, who plays rubber bands? Yeah, I played in a band and everything was made of rubber. Yeah. Anyway, meanwhile, so, you were talking that, you know, you wouldn't to order do 50 things, but you have, as you say, done 50 things. Are there 51 or 52? And you haven't really told us about the last ones or the,
well,
is it just about 50 or is it exactly 50 or is it, you know,
there were a few extras that I didn't include in my project. And, the funny thing about the whistle, you want me to bring the whistleblower site up, JP?
Should we show that? Now let's walk through your site here, Doug, so that you can, so if you want to start your screen share here while I'm talking. And so when you come back,
let me see if I remember how to do this.
So up on the thing, green square.
You see it?
Yep. Here we go.
Okay. So I called the site Those Who Blew the Whistle, testimony and admiration of people who are willing to stand up for something, be it right or wrong. I mean, it's funny how one person's whistleblower is another person's saboteur, or shall I say, traitor. But you know, it all depends on how you look at it. We've had this discussion in the country about Edward Snowden, for example. But here's a quote by Robert Kennedy: "Few men are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, the wrath of their society. Moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Yet it is the one essential vital quality for those who seek to change a world which yields most painfully to change." It's a great quote. And if we don't have people that see something wrong or take it upon themselves to rat something out because there's protection around it, then there's a lot of damage that can happen and a lot of things that will stay the same. And so I wanted to do this testimony to whistleblowers. I'm a person who loves portraiture. JP, is that moving along okay?
Yeah. Scrolling up, we're seeing just what you're seeing, except when I'm talking.
Okay, so we're going to move over to the first set of these, and you can see JFK, Michael Rupert, Sergeant Clifford Stone, and so on, and you can read them. I love portraiture because every face is just a face, and yet every face is different, and it's nuances that put through to somebody the likeness of someone. And it's very challenging for, you know, to paint portraits because they reveal, you know, they reveal everything. If you paint a tree, and you may make a great painting of a tree, but it may not be the tree you're painting. It just, you know, the criteria on portraiture is very important to get likenesses. And I like observing things like that. For a second, I'm going to go backwards. We're going to go back to this. I'm going to try to show you some earlier things that I did, and you can let me know if this is coming up. Can you see that?
I still see your gallery there.
Oh, I see. Okay. I'm trying to figure out how you would see my screen, the screen of my computer where I put the extra photographs.
All right. If you go back to your screen share, you stop the screen share and you start again. You should see a big list, you know, a big page full of all your different windows, and you can click on one of them.
Oh, okay. All right, here we go.
There we are.
See that?
In a minute. There we are.
All right, so this is talking about, I did a series of paintings on the subject of uniform. I was always very fascinated with the idea that a person in a uniform has so much more impression on us than a person not. And if you're ever at a coffee shop on an afternoon and you're talking to this guy, and then he comes into the coffee shop the next day and he's in his police outfit, he's a patrolman or a policeman, it has a completely different feeling than the person you were talking to yesterday, you know, who seemed like just an easygoing, nice guy. And a uniform has a very, very powerful implication. And the uniform of religion is something I explored, being that I was raised Catholic and had my time with Catholic nuns and priests and so on, in the sense of questioning the entire paradigm, the entire belief system. And so this is a painting called Science Times. And so what I wanted to do was put sort of a young, kind of masculine, good-looking priest who also smokes cigarettes and maybe has a shot of whiskey. He's got boxing gloves in the background. Maybe he's a Jesuit. And he's got a little keychain up front there, if you see it. And it's got a little alien, it's a little alien keychain. You got cigarettes and you got the Science Times from the New York Times. So yet you have his books and his wisdom on the other side of the, underneath the newspaper. Well, this, I did a series of about 8 to 10 of these paintings probing the idea of the impression we have from uniforms and so on. So here's a man of faith, but he's also a man of inquiry. He's also a man of questioning his own faith, questioning paradigms, asking, you know, is there something out there beyond what we were taught and what we were told? And so that's what's behind this painting called The Science Times. I'll bring something else up. Here's an early piece of my...
But I just wanted to bring up one of the impressions that I'm getting from this particular picture is that this man's clothing is almost invisible. His body is almost invisible. All you see is his hands and his face. And it's like, don't look at the body.
Sort of goes to black in the background with the hat and the books and everything else. And if you just squint at the image, it's almost like a bottom white area and then leading up to the newspaper. And then it's like a pyramid, a triangle. It goes up the arm to the head and back down to the arm and back around again. And I used to look at a lot of the classical paintings that used to know how to orchestrate this stuff where your eye would travel around the picture. It's very, very interesting science to creating a painting. But this particular painting, and most of the work I do, I just want everyone to know, is that it's all that I do is usually instinctual. Everything is just like, does it feel right? Does it not feel right? It's not so much learned from books and learned from equations or the golden rule or all that kind of stuff. I'm aware of it, but I don't really pay too much attention to it. I don't pay too much attention to color theory. I use my own instincts in everything that I create, so... But I know we have a limited amount of time, JP. We'll move along. This was a piece of my early photorealism. When I first started to paint, I loved auto mechanics and cars and things. And so this is an oil on canvas painting of the front end of my TR6, my Triumph TR6, British car, that I managed to hit into a telephone pole and break my nose in. But I just... thought it was a great example of one of my photorealistic pieces to show people what an illusion this is. This is just paint. There's no chrome. There's no reflection. It's just a lighter color next to a darker color, a cool next to a warm, a this next to a that, and just following a good drawing. It can really give you the illusion that there's chrome and hardness versus the rubber tire, which has got this, rubbery kind of dull quality and hard to explain color to it, like a greenish dull gray. And then everything else is gleaming. And And then you got that feeling of sunlight in the edge of the chrome. And it's all amazing how paint, just paint pushed around on a canvas that can create these, you know, qualities.
Okay. So show us the chrome then.
Oh, didn't you see it?
No, no. We've just been seeing you.
Oh, wait. Oh, that's because I forgot about the screen share.
No, forget the screen share. Look, there we go. So there we are. Go. Oh, look at that. That is. Okay.
See, if I knew I was blabbering without showing it to you, I'd be embarrassed.
Just a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, that is not a photograph.
And the funny thing about that is when people say, oh my God, look at the headlight, look at the reflector and this and that. How did you do that? I tell them, you know, the hardest part of that painting was the tire. The tire was so difficult to get it to feel and look like a tire. And so it's just these odd qualities that some things are easier to paint than others. But and actually, if this image was turned upside down, you'd end up seeing a sky. In the glass of the headlight, you'd end up seeing a park with a walkway with some trees and a sky with clouds in it. But it's an upside down image, a concave image because of the headlight doing that. But, I remember it was a bright sunny day when I had that, composition created with my car. So, all right. So I'm going to move off of that. I'm going to show, one or two more of my early works building up to what I'm doing now. Okay, this was a painting, it's not a painting. This I created this called the Serial Killer, C-E-R-E-A-L Killer, off the Oswald shooting that I was old enough to see live when it happened. I was a kid, 10 years old, and I saw Oswald shot live on television. I was like, holy crow, mom, look at this. And, it was quite a time, and I actually then later on thought about a lot of things and thought about how we just envelop the sugary commercials and news and everything of television, and we eat it up like it's real, like it's you know, telling us the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and it's really junk food in a sense. And so I thought, what better thing to do than to create this image out of trick cereal? So JP, are you seeing the image?
No, I'm seeing you.
Okay, here we go again. I got to do this again. Hold on. I got to remember to go to the screen share.
Yeah, so go to the screen share and then go to the window, select the window, click start screen share. Several
clicks.
How about that? There we go. Oh, that's like a mosaic, like, what do they call it? Pointillist style?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just the trick cereal that came in the box of tricks. I must have eaten about two boxes to create it, but I just took the trick cereal and I looked at the dark tricks and the light tricks and said, all right, now your challenge is to move around these five or six different values in the right way to create the image of Oswald being shot. And it's quite amazing when I look back to realize that there's an expression in the cop's face and in Oswald's face. And it's created somehow by the juxtaposition of these little trick cereals. So, I've always been fascinated with that pointillist, concept of creating imagery. When you go close to a television set or a newspaper, you see dots, and it's those colored dots that our eyes just assemble and get us to recognize an image. So,
back in the days when they were first making, so you can use this moment to swap over pictures, by the way.
Okay.
Back in the days when we were doing our first, computer graphics, people would spend hours and hours typing, into the computer and storing it. These lines of X's and dashes and asterisks and if you stood like 10 feet away from the printout, you'd see a face and it would be the queen. You know, I remember the first internet porn, the first, like, the backside view of this, you know, attractive woman. But it was like, there it is, representing the first internet porn made with some typewriter almost.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we assemble these images with our eyes. It's amazing how the visuals work. This piece is an example of one of the pieces that I did out of my State of Grace series, Portraits of Burn Survivors. And this was a very brave young man who came over to my home and he modeled for me. And that's the painting of him in the background, just to give you and the viewers the idea of how large these paintings were. I wanted to create very large, powerful, not to be ignored portraits of these people who, through no fault of their own, most of them now have to go through life, with their bodies so scarred and altered. And how unprepared our society is for this kind of visual. We're just not educated, to the differences in people and accepting them. We stare and gawk and we don't know what to do. And when I was a kid, my mom and dad, not meaning to do this, but they were just not educated either. They were like, if I saw all kids are curious and they're like, mommy, what's that? And my father would be like, well, just don't look, just turn away and let's go over here and don't say anything to them or don't look at them. And back then it was wheelchair bound people and it was, little people or any number of things, obesity, any number of things. Today we've kind of, the last frontier in this seems to be, the burn survivor. He seems to be the visual leper of society. It's like very hard to face a person who's burned or altered like this, and especially facially burned people. He's not that facially burned in his photograph here, but in the background you can tell his ears are burned off, and we have a hard time with faces. So again, this is a theme through all my work, portraiture, and the face and the power of the face and the power of the painted portrait, which I've always been very, very moved by. And then let me show you the last thing. One other thing here. Let me get that image up now that we know how to do it. This is, let's see. All right. Anybody see this, JP?
Yep. We're seeing,
all right.
Destruction.
Yeah, this is on the right. This is an actual painting I did in honor of a 9/11 first responder, the piece on the right. The reason why I have it next to the Raft of Medusa, I'll explain. The piece on the right I did in honor of this guy named Larry Holloway, who went there, risked his life, got all polluted up, breathed in all these terrible, terrible things, is sick to this very day, and he was never acknowledged by our government or the mayor or anybody as even being there. He was not helped. He was not, nothing happened for him, and he's just been having in this event. And we got some publicity on him. We tried to get it covered. But anyway, the painting on the left is the famous Theodore Jericho painting that inspired my art, called The Raft of the Medusa. And unbeknownst to me, when I made the painting on the right, I was amazed at how similar the composition is. They look the same. I mean, I see that as that's an old time disaster in the French Navy. And on the right is a modern day disaster. Both were scandalous. Both were very controversial. The one on the left was a naval ship that ran aground on a sandbar, and all the men cannibalized each other and only a certain number of men survived. And the Argus, which is a ship way in the distance behind the big wave on the right, was coming to rescue them. And most of the men died, and Theodore Jericho was very moved by the scandalous event of the day, and he painted it. And here I'm moved by a similar event in our time, and painted the remains, and the horizon line is in the same spot. The subject on the right, on the back right, the way the angles go on the vanishing points of the raft and the men on it, everything has like a reminiscent feel to it. I don't know if anyone else would see that, but I do.
Well, not only that, the angles on the, you see under the people on the left.
Yes.
You see them on some form of wreckage, And the record is the same form as,
yes,
as depicted in, you know, it's the same shapes that are licking across. And there's this one that is kind of at this angle. It's not exactly the same angle, but it's, you know, it's very reminiscent. I mean, if you weren't inspired consciously, there's a subconscious archetype coming through here.
Yeah. And if you blurred your eyes and you took it down, just as some abstract shapes, you know, you could almost vision in the painting on the right, that piece of metal sticking up on the left as the sail of, similar to the sail on the boat and so on. So, I just thought that was fascinating. So I put the two together. Okay. Let's get back to the whistleblower series. Okay. Let's get that going here. Screen share. I'm going to be an expert at this soon.
You'll be giving your presentation in Australia before long.
Okay. Can you see it?
Yep.
Okay. So now we're going to scroll down, and here's the 50 paintings all in one shot. We've got five going across. John F. Kennedy, Michael Rupert, Clifford Stone, you can see everyone, Larry Warren from Rendlesham Forest sighting, Colin Andrews, a great man, a great researcher, and the father of the discovery of the crop circles, in a sense. I think he was the first person to coin the term crop circles. A good friend of mine, Chris Bledsoe, who is just a fabulous person, who has an amazing story, just something so hard to explain, who's an experiencer in a otherworldly event. That I included. Bill Ryan from, Project Avalon. I'm not going to name them all, and people can go to my site and look at them. We'll scroll down a little bit. Jesse Ventura, Karen Silkwood, Phil Schneider, Bob Lazar, you know, who really, really got the UFO thing going with his testimony about Area 51 and S4. Amazing how he talked about Area 51 and S4 before any government official ever admitted it even existed. It went on and on and on, and they said, it's all nonsense. And here we are now in an administration who is now, not only have they admitted it, every school kid knows the area, knows the name Area 51. It's funny how it was secretive and not in existence at one point, and now everybody knows Area 51 exists, which is another example of, you know, this, how we start to break down walls. Edward Snowden there, William Binney, Pat Tillman, who I consider to be a total hero, who was a football player, handsome guy, had the world by the butt, could have done anything, played pro ball, and he went and joined the army to fight for his country after 9/11, and found out some very dark things when he was there. And he was marginalized, to put it nicely, Gary McKinnon. But we're seeing all these images going down through the 50. And then below there, I have a great quote that I love by Margaret Mead. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And now I have about the series, why I did this series of work, which people can read on their own. That's a self-portrait of mine that I did a while ago. I thought I'd put that up there. And then this is an interesting little thing. I put this in-progress group of paintings up. This is Dr. James Tracy, Professor James Tracy, who is now in a lawsuit for, as a tenured professor, being fired from Atlantic University in Florida for his views on Sandy Hook. They fired him for his private views, for his views on his own blog, where he did not represent the college. It's his own views. So censorship is alive and well and getting worse and worse. And so I wanted to put him in part of my series. But you can see how I start. I take a white canvas and I wash it with paint. Just wash it down and just get rid of the white. One of the things that one of my styles of working is getting rid of the white canvas, because going against a white canvas is very hard to evaluate lights and darks when the background is so bright. And then from there, real rough with some turpentine and a paintbrush. I'll scratch in the basic where the shoulders are, where the head is, where the eyes align. And you don't really need much. You can see that already. You can get an idea of a portrait and where it's looking from a few lines. Not much there. A few straight lines. Straight line on the hair, straight line coming down here, another straight line. I try to avoid drawing with curved lines. They're very deceptive. I try to start with mostly straight lines. That's what we call a block-in, blocking in the basic feel of it. I don't paint like a person would be taking a pen and writing on a board. I paint from a distance with my arm out full, almost like you have a sword in your arm and you're fighting somebody with a sword. I paint like that. And then here's the final image. When I lock in. So before I lock in, before I'm going to paint eyes, nose, mouth, and this and that, I want to get the general area where the eyes are, where the nose is, where the mouth is. I don't want to paint eyes perfectly on a face that's already still doesn't look like the person, because then you're wasting your time putting all this detail in. So it's a strategy that I've grown to like and work with. And this new series of work, I'm purposely trying to make very painterly. And what I mean by that is that, you know, it's a painting. As much as it looks like it's a portrait and a portrait of a specific person, you can see the paint. You know that it's a painting because we're moving in such an area of realism with computer imagery that what's the point of making another photographic image? There's so much dazzling photography and computer designed imagery now that I want to preserve the look of paint. And then there's a whole comments list where people could go on my site and add a comment if they want and so on. So that's the basic presentation. And I viewed this series of work as one piece of art. I see the 50 as one piece of art. And that's how I view it. I don't view it individually as one, as each painting. And ideally I'd love to show all 50 at once. And if anyone ever wanted to actually own the series of work, I'd love to sell 50 all at once I have a concept for how to display all 50 in one grouping. They're not very large. They're small, kind of smaller paintings. They're about a foot tall. And so it was manageable that way. One thing I wanted to say is that, you know, I see myself as, I can't tell people much about anything that they can't find out themselves about each one of these people. I'm not an expert on anything. I consider myself a pretty average everyday citizen. I consider myself a true patriot. And people may argue with that, but a true patriot is somebody who thinks their country is worth fighting for and worth holding on to the values of our country, the Constitution and the ideals of this country that we've grown up in. And I grew up in an amazing time where I was fortunate. I wasn't in World War II. My dad came home from the war and started the family. And I was, through the grace of the lottery, the draft lottery, I was skipped over for the Vietnam War. But it was an amazing time to be alive. And it was a time when the country was torn up about the Vietnam War, and 58,000 young Americans that were artists and musicians and painters and poets never got to show their stuff and never got to express anything. And I guess it's arguable as to whether we belong there, but, you know, we learned later on that the Gulf of Tonkin was a false flag event. And we're starting to learn more and more about how many things are false flag events. And we're starting to really start to question how we know what we know. And that's something that I'm very interested in, the topic of how we know what we know. And before I go into a little bit of that or anything else, JP, anything else you wanted to highlight or ask?
Yeah, I'd like to, first of all, linearity. Are those paintings displayed in the linear order in which they arrived to you, if you like, put into put into your head, into your lap, onto your, in the end of your paint. I'm now thinking that you paint with a scimitar, you know, like a sword on the end of a stick.
Oh yeah. No, they're not in the order that I created them. If that's what you're asking. John F. Kennedy was one of the last paintings I created. I'm not sure what the first painting was that I created, but it could have been, I know that, for example, Michael Hastings here was a very early work. And, you can actually see on the side here, I scratched a little something in there with my paintbrush. Michael Hastings was a, investigative journalist who tweeted his friends and family and, you know, and said he was really onto something very, very big and very important, and he feared for his life, and he thought that the FBI or a government agency was after him. And then lo and behold, in no time, his car in California, I forget where it was, Hollywood Boulevard or somewhere, hit a tree at like 90 or 100 miles an hour and burst into flames, and the engine flew out of the car, and he was burned beyond recognition. Very, very odd event. And so Michael Hastings was one of the early people that I painted. I know that. This is Gary McKinnon. And again, viewers who want to go to my site, dougauld.com, dougauld.com shows my three different series of work. And then you'll see the whistleblowers on the left, State of Grace in the middle, and my surreal portraits, early works that I did of synchronicity are on there too. When you go to the site, you can go to each image and you'll see a bio underneath. So for example, if I bring up the bio, it's sort of a starter kit for people. It's not really, you know, Wikipedia may not be the greatest thing. It's basically a way for me to show people a little something about each one of these people. And then you can take it from there. If you want to learn more about Gary McKinnon, do some research on your own and you'll find out. But, he was accused of hacking into the Pentagon's computers, and he hung around there. He hacked in there. He's from England, and he hung around in the room of the Pentagon computers, and he found lists of things. He's a UFO guy. He's very interested in UFOs and ETs and everything like that, and the belief in that. And he wanted to see if he could find anything that the government had. And he actually came up with a list of non-terrestrial officers, which is quite fascinating, because that list of officers are not listed in any other area, according to him and the other researchers. So there was 9 non-terrestrial officers, and he also found several ships that have nothing to do with the Navy or the Air Force or anything like that. Like I think the USS Helen Cotter, I think, is one of the ships that he found. And so it really starts to get you to question, as Richard Dolan and some of the great researchers are talking about, do we have a secret space, organization, something behind NASA? Is NASA a front for a more clandestine operation where higher technology stuff is already there and already achieved? And I'm fascinated with all this kind of information myself because, again, I'm fascinated with how we even know what we know. And if we're watching news, listening to the radio, watching news, and if all that news is, I have a list here, all that news is owned by 6 corporations, Comcast, the Walt Disney Company, 21st Century Fox, Time Warner, Viacom, and CBS. That's it. Every bit of our so-called free press is owned by corporations who easily can sit together in a boardroom and decide how our information is going to be doled out and in what way, shape, or form. And it doesn't seem like we have the aggressive investigative journalists anymore. And so I really question, well, how do we know what we know? So that's why I've highlighted some of these great people. This is Dr. John E. Mack, Harvard master's degree and so on in psychiatry at Harvard, and became very, very infamous at Harvard for he went in and he investigated UFO abductees. He went in as a total skeptic. He thought it was nonsense, and he thought he would do an investigation and a report on it. And he went into it, and he ended up a complete believer in it. He said, this is real. These events are real. These incidents are real. These people are telling the truth. These people are completely balanced. It's not provable, but these events in their minds are real. So you'd either have to look at it and say that is either some sort of strange psyop, brainwashing something, or it happened. Either way, it's a phenomenal idea and a phenomenal story. And this is one of those paintings that I really cranked up the paint. Can you see that enlarged, JP?
That's as big as the screen. Yeah, that's all big. Yeah. Who's this?
Okay, and all the colors. So yeah, there's an example of me letting color go a little bit more and abstract brush marks and little flicks of blue and purple and here and there mixing together. It still creates an image. It still creates a likeness of this man. And actually, if you looked at it as a black and white photograph, you'd realize that it's all just value, meaning light to dark, light and dark, like music, high notes to bass. You got the high frequency notes and the piccolos and the high pitched notes. You got the mid range, and then you got the trombones and the bass and the drums and music. It's the same thing in art. I see them both the same way. So, let's see. Pat Tillman, he's another one that I painted with a brushy sort of abstract quality, and you can see when you look at that painting close up, I don't know if it's going to let me go too close to it. Yeah, look at the eyes. You got just a splotch of black with a little brown, with a little red, with a little blue, with a little squiggle of white. And in and of itself, it doesn't make an eye. And then the right eye, in and of itself, if you went in close on the right eye, it makes nothing. It's like maybe it's some little like landscape with a little red mark back there. But,
hints at the eye in the shadow.
Yeah. But you know, your eye kind of mixes it all down and knows what to do with it and creates the image. So, that's the Pat Tillman. And maybe one of the paintings that was a little bit tighter is, for example, Julian Assange, who everybody knows. Okay. That painting, although it's painterly and you can see that it's a painting, it's a little more refined. It's not as brushy and thick with paint. It's a little more refined. Here we have a gentleman that I know you'll appreciate.
Ah, there, Mr. Connecting Consciousness himself.
Yes, Simon Parks. And when I first learned about Simon Parks, it was through Bill Ryan at Project Avalon. And I remember saying to myself, this is simply the most fascinating person I've ever heard about. Like, I'm completely amazed that this person who was so well refined, such a gentleman, had this story and came out with this story. Even as, what was he, a town councillor in Whitby? Is that correct?
He's elected local councillor. Yeah.
Yeah, an elected official.
And they actually, they voted for him after he came out as well.
Yeah, I mean, somebody who doesn't know who he is, when we mean he came out, he didn't come out in the way that most of us think.
To come out as a mantis. I mean, it's really, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, yeah, but to come out as having an extraterrestrial heritage and to be bold about it, but not to be, like, shouting it from the rooftops, but just saying very calmly, actually, yeah, here I am. That paves the way. That gives permission to every, 750 million people on this planet.
I agree. Taking a stand like that. And what I love about the people is that they reelected him, as you said, after he came out, publicly. And he was, of course, he was ridiculed. But then the famous radar base, I think, in England was where he started to gain credibility, because he was invited as part of a select group of people to go to this top secret radar base. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's right. Which gave him credibility as to he's not, you know, just making this stuff up, that he has a connection inside the biggest inside. So that, that's all they needed to do is just say, here you go.
No, so that's why he's one of my whistleblowers. So again, I broadened the term whistleblower to not only be the classic whistleblower like the Edward Snowden or somebody who, is just going to say, Monsanto did this, or somebody is dumping, nuclear waste into a river, or in politics, someone coming out and whistleblowing something or whatever, Watergate or whatever. I wanted to broaden it to people, more extraordinary people that are more obscure. Christopher Bolin is a great guy. I've spoken to him, and he is a 9/11 researcher, and he is just an incredibly dogged 9/11 researcher, and he has dug into the story of 9/11 on a level that our news would never even go to. And so be it that you agree with him or not, if you pay attention to these people and you read what they have to say and you start to connect the dots, this is the key. You first have to open your mind and get yourself out of the mindset. You have to get yourself out of the mindset that all this is conspiracy theory stuff. That's how I believe it was marginalized. It was handled no different than the UFO subject and a lot of other subjects. It was handled through ridicule. And all people seem to fall prey to ridicule. Ridicule is like the worst thing in the world that could happen to someone, is they're made fun of. And these people are ridiculed for their views, and they're fired from their jobs, and their wives leave them, or their kids are embarrassed or whatever. And Chris Bolin's arm was broken by the federal agents in front of his house, according to him. He testified that this is what happened. They threatened him for his work and what he was doing. So what does that say about what he's getting to? Another 9/11 researcher, Dr. Judy Wood here, is someone who is on the opposite end of the spectrum of Chris Bolin, not in the sense where they agree is that they agree that the event is not what we were told. What they don't agree on is how it happened. But a lot of people don't approve of me. They call it a limited hangout. They don't like the idea that one is inaccurate in their information, and they're very, and I understand this. I understand the reason why they do this. But my feeling is I would rather get a person who has never even looked at the subject of 9/11. For example, there are people on the street that never heard of Building 7. I live right outside New York City. And if I said, hey, how did Building 7 fall? They would go, what? What's Building 7? They wouldn't even know what I'm talking about. And most people don't know that Building 7, actually 7 buildings of the World Trade Center complex were destroyed on 9/11. Not 2, 7. And one of them fell without a plane hitting it and nothing else hitting it, from an office fire. So how do you get a 47-story skyscraper to fall from an office fire? If that happened on its own without 9/11 happening, if it just happened on any day and we woke up and found out that a 47-story modern skyscraper fell to the ground from an office fire, I don't think another person would go into a skyscraper. It would be the biggest news. What's that?
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Nobody would go to work.
No. And it would be top news on every news channel every night for weeks, if not a month. And yet it was never covered. Why was it never covered? I mean, it was simply never covered. You never saw it. You never heard. So there, in my opinion, is an example of controlled media. And now Aaron Russo, I know I'm jumping around here. Aaron Russo is a filmmaker, and he made some activist films. And he had the amazing pleasure of meeting one of the Rockefellers. Not Jay, but there's one of the Rockefellers, I'm blanking on the name, and he met this Rockefeller. And Rockefeller brought him into his fold. And he invited him to dinner, and I think Aaron, who is now deceased. He died of cancer. Aaron went to Rockefeller's home and they had this discussion. And Aaron Russo has a video on YouTube everyone needs to see. It's just absolutely fantastic. His story about meeting Rockefeller and what Rockefeller told him. And Rockefeller told him that prior to 9/11, he said that there's going to be an event and this event is going to change the world. And after this event happens, we're going to, our military is going to 5 countries in 7 years and we're going to reshape the Middle East. And he went on this entire talk as if he knew everything about 9/11 before it happened. And Aaron Russo testifies to this. So he is certainly, in my book, a whistleblower, not seen in the same way as others. And of course he could be written off as crazy or nuts or making it up. But again, I mean, these people are ruining their lives. What's in it for a whistleblower? What are they getting? Are they getting fame and fortune? No. Are they making a ton of money? No. It's not working like that. Here's a great guy and is someone who's become a friend of mine. Dan Willis.
Yes, definitely. He's, another previous guest that we'll ever be on here and a regular guest on the station.
Oh, great. Yeah, great. Dan is great. And we've kind of hit it off. We kind of see the world in the same way. And he has that, you know, he was part of the Disclosure Project, that I actually caught unknowingly at the time that it came out. I'm going to guess 2003, but I really don't know. I can't remember when the Disclosure Project came out, but, this is a group of military people that were willing to testify in front of Congress and under a grand jury. They were willing to testify that their stories were true. So who would perjure themselves? Why would you bother to perjure yourself over a story? You're not making money. You're being ridiculed. You're taking your life into your hands. And yet he and a group of amazing people, Paul Hellyer and Larry Warren, who I have on my website, and others, went ahead and testified that their stories are true and that Dan had a high level clearance and picked up radio transmission from a ship near Alaska that saw a orange orb shoot out of the ocean and lift up out of the ocean and take off. And he intercepted the transmission from the ship, and it was evidently documented on radar at, I believe, a speed of 7,000 miles an hour leaving the atmosphere. Okay, now who's making this story up and why? I ask these questions. I'm not saying 100% that I know all this stuff is true, but I'm also saying, well, maybe it is. Maybe that's why we don't hear about it. Maybe we're not supposed to hear about it. But Dan is a great guy, and everyone should really take a look at his website. It's a thewebmatrix.net. That's WEBMATRIX.net. And I have learned a lot from his website. It's a fabulous website, and he goes through a chronology in our government of government programs since the late 40s or maybe even the 30s, on 40s through the war, through up to almost present day. And he shows you projects and government projects that nobody knows about. Some people know about Operation Paperclip, but most people don't know about these projects that we brought Nazi scientists into our country and they went to work in NASA. I mean, many of these people should have been in Nuremberg trials, but they were brought here and they became what NASA is today and what our military is today. And many people just have to Google this. They have to read about Operation Paperclip. And Dan's site is great. He's a great guy, and it's a very educational site. Anybody? Do you see anybody in particular you wanted to? Oh, here's Paul Hellyer. Okay, see that one, JP?
There he is. Yes, we. I haven't had Paul Hellyer on the show per se. I think I produced a show with him on. But yeah, very gracious gentleman.
Yeah, now here's a man that's, you know, I think close to 90 years old. This is the ex-defense minister of Canada. Okay, now how much higher a level of credibility in government does someone want to hear from than a defense minister for our country. So he was a defense minister, I believe, in the 60s. But here is a gentleman who has come out to talk about all the ET races that he's aware of, that he knows about, that our government has either been aware of or is working with. And again, you're going to tell me that Paul Hellyer is going to throw away a great career and a respected career and make up and fabricate some stuff about extraterrestrial races and UFOs and on and on and on. Okay, if it was one person, I go maybe, but then I jump over to Simon Parks and then I hear from, you know, Larry Warren, and then I hear from another person, then you hear one person after another testifying about the truth to this reality. So, that's why I included Mr. Hellyer in there.
Doug, shall we take a little break?
Oh, that would be great. And by the way, I don't know how much time we have in total.
We got about another hour.
Oh, okay. Well, God. All right. Let's take a break.
So, let me just share that screen. And what I'm going to be playing is the tune that you were talking about before that, called The Knowing, and features on vocals Sean and Fuse. There we go. Here we are.
Oh, okay.
Young ones, what is your purpose? Why are you here? Living wasn't made easy, wasn't made clear. Listen, not from the outside, listen from here. It's coming, the game to an end now, nothing to fear. Keep yourself growing with love ever flowing. Forgiveness will set yourself free. It's all you have to do. It's much simpler than they told you. Remember, keep all together, work it all out. Laughter will lighten your days, so laugh it all out. Quiet, there's a time to be silent, so sit and be still. Playing, run fast with the wind till you had your fill. When sadness brings crying, there's no sense denying. Let crying empty your tears. It's all you have to do. It's just a door that you must pass through. I'm sorry, this is all I can tell you to show you the way. I'm going, can't stay any longer, leaving today. The knowing is hidden within you, deep in your heart. In time, you have plenty of time to play out your part. So just keep
You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Welcome back. Let me just turn my camera back on. Bang. There we are. See, I'm still here. Yes. And I still look just as bad. Anyway, so my guest is Doug Auld. Great to have you on. This is, it's kind of a first for me, you know, to do this kind of very visual presentation with, you know, having done 5 years of radio, but it just seems to be a kind of natural turn of the spiral that, you know, I start doing visuals and stuff like that. So it's a great pleasure to do that. Not that I like being on camera. That's just, you know, I'm just emphasizing that. Some people are all right with it, but you know, whatever. So, you know, some of the things that people have been saying in the chat room, some of these pictures are like, as you were saying, like hyper photographic. Some of them, they just stand out. Some of them are impressionist. It's a very yes. great range. It's like you're trying all the, is it like variations on a theme, like how to draw a portrait? Is there another layer to this, Doug? Old.
Yeah, those are good questions and good observations by the chat room. Again, they're all likenesses. You know, you can say that is John F. Kennedy. That is Michael Rupert, Sergeant Clifford, Stone, Lloyd Pye, Larry Warren and so on. So they're all likenesses, but, they're all approached in a subtly different way. You know, one forehead may be very smooth. Here's Michael Rupert. Okay, there's a little more paint, a little more swirl, a little bit more marking, bright blue mark that doesn't really belong there, but I liked it. Look at the little squiggle that's going through the mustache, that little kind of squiggle going through there, and then a little blue mark over here. So your eye picks up some of the blue over here, jumps over here and picks up a little more. There's a little bit in the hair and so on. I try to keep myself amused and I try to keep myself spontaneous, just like saying, okay, you're doing another one. Let's pretend it's the first time and you're doing one and what are you going to come up with here? And then, you know, I'll jump to another one. This portrait I really like. I like this portrait a lot. Bob Dean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It totally, you know, even though most of the time we see Bob Dean, his hair is kind of up. You've got his hair kind of, as I say, down. But,
yeah.
The warmth that you've captured, in his, visage, the general aura of him comes across very well on this one. You know, immediately I saw that. Hang on, so old bloke. Oh, Bob Dean, yeah. You know, and
yeah.
somehow the color seems to saturate as you look at it. I don't know how this is working, but it's like, as you look at the painting and some probably as my left, right brain sees it, is like it kind of 3Ds it. It brings it out into relief. It's fascinating. It's fascinating.
Well, I don't really know what you're seeing on your side. That's the funny thing about computers is I'm looking at one color combination and believing and hoping it's coming somewhat similar to you over there. We all see things differently through the computer screens that we have. And maybe even much like how we all see something different through our own eyes, each other when we're out in the world and
well,
someone
tell
says,
me all about hey, it. I'm supposed to be colorblind, you see.
Okay.
Well, I just see a different frequency band, but, you know, okay. I see different shades of blue as, women see different shades of red. I don't know if that's more of a male thing or a female thing, and, you know, but, I find that I can, you know, discern between different shades of, say, navy and indigo and deep, you know, all those things. Whereas, I'm having trouble between the browns and the greens. I can't
right,
see there.
Right.
So it's like, I just see things differently. I have a different perspective yeah. on the spectrum.
You do in many ways. So yeah, but you know, when you look at this portrait, it's got a strong feel to it. I mean, again, you know how I said earlier that I like to draw with sort of, a lot of times I like to draw with straight lines. If you look at the hair, it's like, you know, just almost like a, you know, a point on the top, an angle down to the ear, an angle down on the other side, and on and on and on. And then I'll work a curve into it when appropriate. But, I like to block and box things out like that. And, usually every time I paint, like I was talking to somebody about art the other day, and I said, and someone was asking me, you have so much life in the eyes of your paintings. There's so much life in these people. And one of the reasons, one of the things I told them is I never paint one eye to match the other eye. There's never a time where I paint the left eye exactly like the right eye. You know, it will always be somewhat different. It's always a different approach. Let me see if we can find some examples. Let's go over to,
even in Bob Dean, I was just thinking, certainly, his, a semi-profile shot. But everybody's got their facedness, you know, like we've got our handedness, our left and right handedness.
Yeah.
Obviously you know all about this, but, like everybody's got like two halves. We've got two similar looking people in the same body. And maybe this is also something connected with this male female thing, you know, the anima and animus, but, that one side of them I see as personality and the other side I see as subconscious or soul.
Huh.
How do you experience facedness, as it were?
Well, I think I probably look at it a little bit more mechanical than you. I'm a very analytical person as far as, you know, when I look at someone's face, I take observations of, you know, how someone's nose could be crooked, but yet it looks correct. Look at the twisting turn of Bob Dean's nose there, and yet it looks correct. It doesn't look like, oh my God, his nose is like, you know, twisting off. If you saw the, you know, the imagery of him, in this particular light, that's how it came off. So if you ever, and I'm sure you've seen these, JP, and I'm sure some of the viewers have seen this too. If you ever saw one side of your face matched by its exact likeness, it looks weird. If it's a mirror of your exact face over here, then they mirror it over here rather than the other side of your face. It doesn't look like you. It looks strange. So we somehow take these two halves that are different, and but they're close enough where somehow they work, and that's what makes the character of a person. That's sort of how I look at it.
Well,
the Lloyd Pye.
Lloyd Pye. Yeah, hang on a second, Doug, because I actually did that. just to demonstrate this, let me just see if I'll go and share this particular screen here. Where is it? Come on, screen share.
Am I going to see this?
Yeah, you'll see this. There we are. So, and then I do that. Now, can you see this? No.
It's gonna hold on. Oh, almost.
Gonna take a little while. There we are. Coming up. There we are.
Oh yeah. I gotta look at it.
Right. Oh, is it flashing?
It's flashing.
Let's see if that's what. I'm using, hang on, let me just open it.
It froze for a second and then it was gone.
Yeah, I'm gonna use a different thing that will give a better picture.
I lost you now, but.
All right. Okay.
Oh yeah, there it is. Yep.
Right. And am I muted?
No, I hear you.
Okay, good. I don't know why my mute is. Anyway, I got two mutes. Anyhow, so there I am. see, I have a mole on my. Where is it? I'm looking. It's my left. Yeah, it's above my left eye. That's above my left eye. So it looks like that's my demon side. That's my eye. I got horns. or a little smiley face, I don't know, or an upside down face. Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, that's my my right hand side, which is very nerdy and student like.
Yeah, but this doesn't look that drastic. It's pretty, you know, it's different. It's definitely different. Your mustache is different, and the design of things is different, and so on. But it's still like more. It's actually more legible than I think some other people's faces would be.
Yeah. I quite like the moustache on the left, to be honest. That's quite a nice style, the way it's kind of
it
drops down.
Yeah.
It's got a nice line to it. The other one's a bit wishy-washy. Anywho, so there we
go. Do you have devil's horns ready to come out of that left image or what there? Because
it's like a unicorn or something. my girlfriend likes to demonize me, and she says that's why my horn is growing out. Anyway, so that's what happens to me when I mirror myself.
Sure. Are you seeing the Lloyd Pye image now?
Now we are, yes.
Okay. So this is a good example of if you hide one eye and then hide the other, both look very different, yet both work as his eyes. They're languaged very different. I call it language the way I articulate them. They're language very different. And yet, you know, there's a difference between the two of them. They're painted very differently. And this is a portrait that I really like. There's something about the violets, the blue and the violets and the mauve kind of quality in his forehead that pick up on the hair and pick up on the beard. And that's another thing you try to do. You try to move local color around. You try to say, well, I have a little over here. Let me move it over there. Let me bring this up here and let me pull this down there. And, you know, in the end, it's, hopefully an image that's pleasing or that's something that you like to look at. So, not only are you looking for likeness, but you're looking to make a piece of art. You're looking for something that has a certain expression in it. Also, the nose, they just have very little flick of red right in the right spot for his nose, for his nostril above the black mark on the other side is very telling and very key. And all these things contribute to make a personality. Of course, Lloyd Pye was the gentleman that did all the work on the Star Child skull. Are you you're up on that, right, JP?
Forbidden archaeology.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Lloyd Pye, hang on, is he the Hidden History of Civilization, the massive book? Is that Klaus Donner? I got it around the wrong way.
Yeah, it's Klaus Donner. Yeah, he's Lloyd Pye is the one who did an entire. Almost life's work later on in his life about the Star Child skull. It's a skull that has no reference to a human being. It's a skull that was found and it really doesn't look like a human being. It's got the strangest qualities in the skull that, you know, he maintained was some sort of evidence or proof of an extraterrestrial type of skull. I can't verify it or not. I'm just saying that he thought enough of it that he dedicated a lot of his work into it. Let me see if the bio may show something. I don't know. Paranormal researcher and the Star Child skull. So, you know, certainly somebody could look that up if they liked. Larry Warren, is another portrait, strong portrait that I like. And, Larry friends with, Peter Robbins, researcher Peter Robbins. They co-wrote a book on Rendlesham Forest, Left at East Gate. It's called Left at East Gate. Fabulous book and fascinating story of the nuclear base in England, RAF Bentwaters, I think it was called, also called Rendlesham Forest Incident. Do you know much about that in England?
Yes, I've had quite a few people mention this. Of course, it's classic British UFO lore.
Sure.
Yeah, and Sasha Christie has been on talking about her take on that. But it's a really big thing in Britain. The whole, you know, and in a way, it sometimes feels like it's, I don't know, it's like the Wailing Wall or something. It's like too much account is taken of this. Rather than the account of 100,000 people who get abducted every year and the 10,000 people get, you know, it's like, hey, look at this. Isn't this interesting? Look at the little details here. Don't look over there where you see the, it's like three military UFOs with swastikas flying over, you know, and, you know, it's a bit of a distraction to my, you know, I'm not saying that these people are, consciously perpetrating it. And I think there's a lot more stirring. You know, a lot of people, you know, they don't really need much encouragement to do what they do.
You know? Yeah.
And, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take much more to just keep them doing it forever. You know, just keep feeding whatever it is that feeds the hunger of it.
So I
go ahead.
It's a very good point, and you don't really know where one thing ends and one thing begins and does something. One of the fascinating problems, and I think, aspects of the UFO world and the researchers and everything. Of course, it's such a difficult world to operate in. It's so murky and hard to tell what's real and not real, and there's so little evidence and proof and argument about every little thing and this and that. So you wonder if the career of it starts to take over and somebody is talking about it so long that they go on a talk circuit, and now the talk circuit becomes you know, I mean, listen, I'll show you another person, because Travis Walton is a great example of this. Everyone, many of the viewers and people will understand or know about the movie Fire in the Sky. And Travis Walton right here, who I had the pleasure of meeting a year or so ago up in Maine with Chris Bledsoe, the experience of Chris Bledsoe. I went up with him and we met Travis and so on, and he's the smartest guy and the greatest guy, really sharp guy, nice guy, musician, quiet, kind of dignified. And he's, you know, this is not the picture that we're sold about these, you know, loggers or country hicks in the backwoods that happened to see something and made a big deal out of it. When somebody is doing what Travis is doing for as long as he's doing it, to me, it rings of some sort of, authenticity that you should at least give it its due or pay attention to it. And, I think he's going on 40 years since his event happened. And of course they made the movie Fire in the Sky, which kind of, you know, embellished it and added stuff to it for entertainment value. But it's quite a story, quite a remarkable story. And they all pass lie detector tests. I mean, I don't know who goes ahead and does something and all the witnesses pass lie detector tests. I know that's not the bottom line of all things, but still it's an indicator. And they went through and they did it and this and that. And I don't know that it's made his life much better than if it never happened. I mean, maybe he would have had a better job and a better life and so on. And this has been something that is just that he's carried for all these years. So I respect that, and I wanted to include him in the series. And again, people can look at it and they can decide for themselves. I'm not, something I'd like to express to everybody is that, this series of mine, is more taken on, should be taken on spirit. It's the spirit of the intention of the series. There could have been 100 different people that I chose. I could have chosen different people. And I've gotten many letters and people that told me, Doug, great work, but how about this person? How about that person? You know, why didn't you include Dr. Stephen Greer? Why didn't you include, this one or that one or whatever? And yes, I agree. I mean, if I continue, I'll look into other things and I'll do other people. There's other amazing whistleblowers who have been working with more concrete stuff, political stuff, military stuff, FBI, CIA, spying, and on and on. I think Thomas Drake is in here. Of course, here's Frank Serpico, who blew the whistle many years ago on police corruption in New York City. That's a cool painting. I kind of like the paint in the glasses. Okay. Which is supposed, okay. So glass, everyone knows you're seeing through the glasses. And yet the white here is so opaque. I made the white very obvious with the brush strokes so that not only it's an illusion, you're supposed to be seeing through it, but you're actually seeing on it. And same with the corner of this glass. And glass is always fascinating to paint. And if you articulate some of the details, you really don't have to articulate other things that the mind's eye will just complete, like this ear. That ear is just an abstract blotch of nothingness. I mean, it's just like one brushstroke with a little mark and a little cut of paint on it, a little bit of white smeared on it. Yet it seems to suffice for an ear. And that's the part of the painting that I'm enjoying now, rather than spelling the ear out. in the past when I used to paint and when I did the series of burn survivors, I spelled everything out because that's what the burn survivors required. They required a real articulation of those paintings because the series wouldn't have been as powerful as it was at the time. But this series of work I'm looking to do to go in other places.
Sunny Street. What's that? I want to direct you to a couple because I've got some questions. But anyway, complete this one and I'll come back in.
Okay. Now this poor guy in a sense is named Sunny Hsu, and he's an immigrant in New York City. He lived in New York City. He was murdered, and it's a heartbreaking story when I heard about it. There's a great guy that's on some of the blogs and sites that I go to named William Gallison. He's a great musician, New York musician, jazz musician, and world famous harmonica player. And Sonny was his friend, and he took it upon himself to do an entire blog and report on Sonny Hsu, because this man had no one to stand up for him. But it seems like he was involved in some sort of scam where the officials in New York City wanted to steal his real estate. He owned land or property, and somehow without much backing, he was challenged as to the ownership of his property, of his land or his condo or his home or whatever. And as he pursued it and pursued it harder, and the police couldn't frighten him out of it, the story gets absolutely scary bizarre on how they came after him. And he told his friends, he told William and he told several other friends that he said, listen, he said, I want you to know I would never kill myself. I'm going to tell you my patterns. I'm going to tell you what I do. He said, I'm afraid for my life. They want me gone. And he said, so I go to work this way. I go down these streets. I do this. I do that. I run over here and then I go home. And that's what I'll be doing. And if anything else happens, you know what happened. And he was found in some obscure area where he never would have been. And his back of his head was smashed in and he was murdered. And, so the story of Sonny Hsu, is easily, I think Googled and found, and you can go to the website. I believe he's on there. Let me see the bio. Let's see. Yeah. The Murder of Sonny Hsu. And this is the blog that you can find it. So just go to my website. And if you're just interested in reading about this, you can read about it. And so in his death and in his, you know, after his remnants of his life here, I included him in my whistleblower series.
Okay. Thank you, Doug. Now listen, there are some places where there's a painting on the wall and the painting seems to follow you around the room. Marsha Coleman Adebayo.
Yes.
Has that quality. What's her story?
Let's find her. Okay, there she is. Yeah, that's a painting that I really love the colors and the tones of this painting too. And again, it's another painting where you really know that there's paint there and so on. And Marsha, let's real quick. She was with the Environmental Protection Agency. And she ratted out hostile work environments. She was diagnosed with hypertension and all sorts of stuff, and they tried to marginalize her in a lot of ways, and she became on the board of directors of National Whistleblower Center and so on. And so, you know, I'm just kind of breezing through this fast because I'm trying to remember the exacts on her. A federal jury found EPA guilty of violating the civil rights of Coleman Adebayo on the basis of race, sex, color, and hostile work environment. They tried to get rid of her. They tried to silence her for her observations with the EPA by marginalizing her through race and so on. And so she's quite a powerful woman, quite an amazing woman to stand up to them. And so that was her involvement. But she has, her portrait. Has some nice aspects of it, but this is the kind of painting you're talking about where you walk over there and she's looking at you, you walk over here and she's looking at you, and it, kind of follows you around the room. Is that what you were referring to?
Yep, that's the one.
Yeah.
And you know, like you're saying, you know, it's all in the eyes that they form the real focal point of the whole picture. And the, what are they? Two tiny ziggurats.
Yeah.
In these dark pools. And somehow that, you know, it just, she's just looking at you, you know, it's amazing. And there's a feeling coming across.
Yeah.
Tell me about the feeling that the, when you were painting those eyes, what was the feeling that you were intending?
Well, I mean, it was, she's got a very penetrating look, a very determined and penetrating and almost a challenging look to her, confident, but very just penetrating look. And I'll take note of someone where someone's eyes may be more, more, you know, refined or relaxed or resigned or something. Hers aren't. Hers aren't at all. They're really right there. You know, and of course all these things happen with us when we open our eyes a certain way and when with our expressions say so much in eyebrows and in eyes and in, if we flare our nostrils and so on. So, I do remember this. Of course I did 50 and I don't remember every aspect of every one of them while I was working on them, but I remember that I really wanted her make her eyes dark, really, really black and penetrating with a very, very good contrast. And that's the little white in the eye. So the whites of her eyes behind her pupils are grayish. And, because usually your eyes are picking up the reflected light of the room. We call it white, but it's not white. White is more like if you looked at a piece of paper, under bright light, that's more like white. We use the word white and black and this and that and everything else to approximate something that's not really accurately pure white. It's an off-white. If I was to take the color of her eyes and put it on a white canvas alone, it would look dark gray. It would probably be very dark if you were to compare the whites of her eyes to a white piece of paper. So, but I made sure that I saved some of the brighter highlights for these little spots in her eyes, which are brighter than the surrounding white. So that the contrast between the black and the white is very strong and that gets your attention. And then of course I flick those little pieces, the same pieces into the hair on the edge of the hair up here. And, just these zigzags and everything that try to visually explain the feeling that I have about this person and what strikes me about them.
Okay. But something else comes across and I don't know if you did it or if it comes that I'm projecting it. But I see her eyes as brown, which is really low frequency red against the black.
Mm.
I see infrared coming through the black space in her eyes. Is that me?
Wow.
Or am I just, am I kind of RVing her sense, you know, or your sense of what was coming across? Because what I'm talking about is warmth.
Well, again, I paint my paintings and I make them through in my instinctual intuitions about these people. I don't really know what other people see. So I don't know what you see. I don't know what you bring. In a way, we all complete these images. Everybody completes the painting through your perceptions, your intuitions, the things you pick up on. So I really don't know what you see. So I'm fascinated to hear you tell me that. Because I may see something different. I mean, I may see strength and determination and you may see warmth. I do see compassion. I see warmth and compassion, but I really see strength and determination and a sort of a piercing, direct look.
Yeah, yeah. But no, what I'm saying is that it's got this, it's a higher love. It's hard to put it across. But you know, it's not a hatred. Defiance.
No, not at all. I agree with you.
The love, you know, and that's what touches the heart.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And then you have to ask yourself, how much is her mouth contributing to that? And how much is, The way her forehead is shaped and so on, whether there's lines and ridges in her forehead or a frown in her face. And then her mouth, mouths are very interesting because there's a very subtle thing in her mouth that's almost working towards a smile, but it's not. It's just almost lifting up on that one corner over here and maybe just slightly over here, where if it was just a millimeter down lower, it would be a frown. And I'm always fascinated with that. I'm always fascinated with the subtlest motion from my brush on something that will change a person's expression. And many times, JP, I've been working on something and I have it just right and I want it a little better and I lose it. And then I scrape the whole thing down. I'm like, damn, that's it. I lost it. That's it. I overworked the painting. And overworking a painting is a common thing for people, artists. And a lot of times you just have to let the spontaneity, it's a balance between technique and accomplishment and doing a good job, so to speak, and also having a spontaneous feel in the image. And it's not an easy high wire act. It is a high wire act for sure, because if you maybe liken it to cooking, if you're making a soup and you go a little too heavy with the spices and all of a sudden you can't go backwards, you're like, oh, there goes the soup. It's got too much sugar or too much salt or too much
salt. That's when you put the vodka in it.
yeah. And you have a shot of tequila. So, another one that I like, unless you wanted to speak about that some more.
No, the next one I was, that draws my eye for some reason is, Cliff Stone. Sergeant Cliff Stone, right at the top.
Yeah.
Right at the top there.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's one of my latest paintings, if not my last. It's almost my last. I think that could be my last painting. Yeah. And I love this. I love this painting. This one, this something about this painting I love.
Again, it's got again, a kind of bas relief feel to it of some, in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what it is about this. I mean, particularly in the thumbnails, when I'm looking through the thumbnail pictures, It has a depth or a you know, it's coming out towards me.
Yes,
you know,
I
agree. 3D sort of effect.
Yeah, well, the nose and front portion of the face is definitely ahead of the cheeks and the back part of the face, and you kind of get that. You kind of get that chin and nose and frontal part of the face is forward. And the you know, the background and a little bit of the shoulders and everything seems to recede back there. And, yeah, I mean, this, you know, again, one of the aspects of, and the mystery of making art is that there are these things that happen and go on. I mean, one of the things I love about this painting is this on this side of the cheek, the wide side of the cheek, this grayish, bluish kind of quality there is picked up in the shirt, it's picked up in the background, and it's picked up here in the eyebrow, and it's above the mouth here, this grayish quality. And grays are very, very important in the making of a portrait. There's a lot of grays and a lot of things where, because our face, our skin is transparent, it's translucent, it's refractive, it's reflective. You're seeing through it. It's, you know, if you're wearing a red shirt, it's picking up red in the bottom of your face. If you're wearing blue, the blue is in there. It's very, very interesting. It's reflecting the environment around you. And some of the great painters like, John Singer Sargent, who I'm just always been in such admiration of, he'd paint these outdoor watercolors and portraits of, you know, people lounging on a Sunday down near the river under green trees and grass and beautiful colored flowers, and all the colors of all of the environment would be in their skin. And you'd be like, well, how could that be in their skin? I mean, their skin is supposed to be skin tone. It's supposed to be pink or whatever we call skin tone. Well, it's not. It's a lot of things when you're out in an environment, and that's what contributes to the likeness of a portrait, is getting a lot of that in there. Again, both eyes painted very differently. And this little swatch of darker brown there, a darker gray. I see it as gray. I don't know what you see it right here. And then a little lighter gray and then the red in there. And there's a feeling of thinness in the skin and thickness of the skin when you come towards bone or when you come towards the vascular system. You'll see all different changes in somebody's face. But, yeah. That's one of my latest ones. And I love the just the little gestural feeling of what his shirt looked like. It's not, again, in my youth, I would paint this all out so realistic. They'd be like, oh my God, that is so real. And I've learned from looking at the old masters and some of the great painters that holy crow, they did a little swatch here and a little blotch there. And it looks more realistic than somebody that bothered to paint every button and every mark on the shirt. And so it's called economy of action, economy of brush. You know, less is more. And that gets into Chinese painting and all sorts of other stuff where little marks and little things can say so much.
Yeah, I love the, it gives a hint of like he's wearing a kind of epaulette type, slightly military looking shirt. You know, like he's got stripes on. There's a sense of that, you know, there is a sergeant and there you got three stripes, you know, there's a hint at that as well.
There's also something about his eyes that are not really looking directly at you. They are, but they're not. They're looking up and out a little gaze past you. And that's what I pick up from his eyes. I pick up his eyes are not looking directly at me. Sometimes I look at them and it looks like they are looking directly at me, but then they look like they're moving off. And it's, it's the enigma of the paintings that make them interesting to me. Every painting is different. Every painting has a different quality to it. So, but go ahead.
No, and the other thing you were saying, you're talking about foreheads. One of the things people say about foreheads is that every person's line, the lines on people's foreheads are unique to them. It's like a fingerprint.
Yeah.
And one doesn't think about that so much, but it's true. This is how people get identified, you know, these people identifying clones and things like that because they've got slightly different frown lines because they have different experience, you see. And as an artist, what you're seeing, you're picking up all the person's experience etched onto their parchment.
Yeah.
As you were saying, you know, as you were talking before, I was thinking, so that's interesting. So basically what your artist is doing here is studying how skin responds to different environments.
Sure. Exactly. And then from the inside, how a person's life experience comes through and mitigates that entire visual experience. I mean, he's got that little indentation on the center of his nose that just goes in a little bit that adds so much character to his portrait. This little mark right here, if you can see my cursor, that is Clifford's nose. That's without that, it's not him. And that little subtlety right there. And this carving out, this mark here, there, and there. It's like this, up, up, and up. It's almost like a seven or whatever you want to call it. It's so much of like this brow is going up. There's a curiosity in his face. And he looks like he's very experienced and he's no newcomer to whatever he's up to. He's like, I see years and years of bark on this guy in a sense, like a tree that's been around and he's kind of seen it and he knows things. He knows things maybe that other people don't know. And, so I find it a fascinating portrait. I really like this portrait a lot.
Yes, indeed. And as I said, it really comes out to you. I mean, if he ever did a book, this would be the picture on the cover, wouldn't it?
Well, I would hope so.
You'd be insulted.
If he ever hears this interview or maybe, I know Dan Willis is his friend. Maybe Dan can tell him he's certainly welcome to use the portrait for anything he wants. Just like Dan has taken his portrait and he's used it for his, Facebook page. He uses his portrait and, I'd be honored for any of them to use these paintings. The John F. Kennedy portrait kind of choked me up. I think it's the only painting I did that did that. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, but when I painted this painting, I had a little bit of a tears in my eyes about, I don't know if it was 10, I was 10 when he was assassinated. And I remember that day very well. And I was in school and they sent us all home. And I remember the morbid, horrible feeling in this country every day on TV with the horses marching in the coffin and the, in the horse-drawn, you know, thing and the whole thing. It was just so dark and morbid. And JFK was the whistleblower. I mean, this is a person who talked about secret government, secret societies. He said, there's a plot fomented against the American people. I must warn the people of this plot. If you really just listen to his speeches and some of the things he said prior to him being offed, he was really talking about the very, very stuff that so much of us are talking about today. And he saw it from the inside. The secret government, he said there's an army and a military that runs on its own budget that has no oversight, no congressional oversight, that nobody knows about. Nobody knows how it's funded. He can't get to it. I mean, some of the things he talked about are incredible. And if people go back and listen to his speech about secrecy, the secrecy speech, I think he did it several months before he was, killed. It says it all. And I think that set the tempo. I think that's where the military industrial complex or whatever is going on in this country that's behind the scene laid down, some of the rules. And, of course, this is my instinct and my intuition. And, this is all gray area stuff, but, that was the end of that. And we've had other people to come out and say this. Senator Daniel Inouye, of Hawaii spoke about the same thing before he died. He said there is a secret government with its own Air Force, its own army, its own money, its own funding that has nothing to do with Congress's approval, oversight, or the knowledge of the United States, the people of this country, a democracy. So what is that? What do we make of another politician saying that? And others have come out and said it. So I consider him the whistleblower, in that regard. And something in this face that's sad to me. I don't know if you, JP, do you pick anything up that's sad in this portrait or no?
Well, it's his, well, again, it's all in the eyes. His right eye is looking straight ahead. Now, if he was talking to you, both of his eyes would be focused towards you. But his left eye is drifted a bit. Some people would say that's a lazy eye. But what that is that's an eye that's held in idealism. It's a dreamy eye.
Yeah.
He's holding the vision in that other eye. That's what I'm seeing in that painting there. I don't know what, because, his eyes aren't focused. It's definitely, squint, as we say.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's a very, very interesting observation. And that's what I really don't, it's not my place to want to convince anybody of what my paintings mean. That's what art is all about. It's like you look at it and you teach me. I did this instinctually. I do my work in a trance, and I don't want to say in a trance to make it some sort of mystical sounding thing. It's not, but I get going and I get working. And when I'm working and I'm really in the groove, time kind of disappears and everything kind of gets blurry. And I know I'm in the thing and I love that feeling, and, things come out and go a certain way that's hard to explain. It's not like I can say that, well, now I'm going to make a dreamy eye and now I'm going to make an eye looking straight at me. I don't think about it that way at all. I analyze what I'm looking at, and somehow I'm drawn to say this is that and this is that, and that's how that's going to be. And, you know, even the mouth, I mean, you got a dark, strong corner in the mouth right here, and you got a mouth fading away over here, and this kind of end is getting softer and fading away. Why? It gives me a feeling. It gives me a feeling he's disappearing, or he's fading. He's fading from our memory or our view or whatever. And, I don't know. It's just instinctual stuff.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I'm thinking, well, why would he be? Oh, well, that's because he's got a bright light to his right, you know, so that to me, that's, that could be a heavenly light shining down on him and reflecting off it.
Yeah. Oh, true. Yeah. I mean, there is a light
again,
source you can see.
Again, I'm going back into the dream world of this.
Yeah. But again, this is everybody's province to just decide for themselves what they see in a particular piece of art or a painting. And, you know, I guess you could interpret it as red, white, and blue too, because you got a blue background. You got, a brownish orange. It's not red, but there's a little bit of red here. And then you got white in the face and in the, I mean, it's a white colored shirt, even though it's not pure white. Obviously, like the border of this painting is white. It's not what this shirt, even though it's white, is in the shadow. So it looks off color. So it's got a red, white, blue kind of patriotic kind of American thing going there, a little flecks of red in the background. And again, I think, you know, I just said, Mom, this is how I'm going to do this. I didn't say, JP, I'm going to make a painting of JFK with the colors of the flag. I didn't say that when I did it. It just went there.
So, Doug Auld, we are at the end of our show. Isn't that amazing? 2 hours, bam, gone by.
Oh, wow.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your art with us. This has been Ever Beyond. You have been Doug Auld. Say goodnight. Where do people find you? And if somebody does want to buy those 50 paintings all in one go, how do they get hold of you?
Okay, you go to my website, DougAuld.com, go into any of my series, and there's contact buttons on every one of them. The Whistleblower site has a contact, and all of them have a contact, so I can easily be found.
Thank you so much, Doug Auld. Let's just play the outro. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you
and good night.
Beyond.